Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Atomic batteries to power, Batman.
Yes.
Welcome back to Ray and Cam's Cold War show.
Yes.
With the demise recently of our Caesar show, we haven't spoken in 2 weeks. And whilst I liked having a week off, I miss you, buddy. I miss your happy little, you know, pixie face.
Thank you. Yeah. And I miss what you provide. And I'm going to leave that right there. But you were missed. You were missed. Parts of you.
Parts. Right.
The good parts.
The good parts. My only good part. So, last time on this here Cold War show, this is episode 227, for the record, we saw that the Marshall Plan was the USA's way of buying their way into the European economy. For those of you who just joining us,
right,
we're talking about the creation of NATO at the moment, taking a break from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
We want to talk about NATO.
Right.
Now, the Marshall Plan publicly.
Yeah.
It was and still is kind of thought of, referred to as an act of charity. But as we saw last time, privately, in the United States, in the thought leaders, in government, in business, they knew that it was serving the interests of the United States. The United States, after World War II, needed markets to sell their products to, or else their own economy would flounder, flubber.
Tank again.
Flummox.
Yeah.
Tank.
Yeah.
And they also needed to keep those markets open to American capitalism. You know, having those markets end up in the Soviet trading bloc would not be good. So they needed a way of locking in as much of the world as possible into the American capitalist system, the trading bloc. Right. And the Soviets, on the other hand, saw the Marshall Plan as a U.S. plot to control Europe,
right,
to control the destiny of Europe, which in many ways it was. And the Soviets understood that at the time. You know, they sort of tried to warn Europe about it, but Europe didn't give a fuck. Like, Western Europe was like, motherfucker, are you going to give us $13 billion? No, then shut the fuck up.
Right. Well, that was the other part of it. Yes, America was going to do something that benefited itself, but it was going to be in the form of charity. But you're right. Europe was like, yeah, we need something. Now, at first, we were thinking we need bucks to rebuild because there's very few buildings that don't have a bullet hole in it. But as we're going to find, and the reason we're doing this is because Europe wanted more than just money. They wanted security. They wanted physical, military, whatever security. And the Americans, because of our tradition, because of George Washington, were very reluctant. We're like, we will give you $13 billion. What we don't want to give you is any kind of promises. And so what we're going to see now is that the various sides are going to kind of, almost like boxers, squaring up and kind of testing each other. The British have an agenda, the French have an agenda, the Americans have an agenda, and they're going to go round and round, and each part is going to try to get what they want without giving up too much. But that's the game that's being played right now, and you throw in money, you throw in fear, you throw in security, and so it's a very interesting time for the Americans and for the Europeans as well.
It was basically like an open marriage or, a threesome.
Yes.
Everyone's trying to get what they want.
Right.
And they've got to give a little bit too. But mostly you're just thinking about what you're going to get out of the threesome.
Give a little get a little. Yeah, but America wanted it all. But like you've said ad nauseum, and it's absolutely true, America was one of the few, if not the only, undevastated countries. Our economy was ready and roaring to go. None of our buildings were destroyed. We didn't have millions of deaths. We had tons of workers. We needed markets for them. And we see an opportunity. Is it cruel? Is it self-serving? Sure. But does everybody do it? Sure. If another country had the opportunity, would they do it? Absolutely. America's just taking advantage of this unique set of circumstances.
And I wouldn't depict it as cruel,
not
necessarily.
Cruel. Self-serving.
Self-serving, sure.
Yeah.
But, most human acts of kindness are self-serving
minor
at one level or another.
Yeah.
Now, the Soviets weren't the only people who saw this as a plot for America to take over Europe. Right. Ernest Bevin, the UK's foreign minister, whispered to his private secretary during one of the foreign minister conferences in, I think it was 1947, this really is the birth of the Western Bloc.
Right.
And he understood.
Yeah, Bevin is an interesting person. We don't have to go into him, but he literally brought himself up for nothing. Very intelligent, very driven. He was very imaginative. Sometimes not great on the details, and he certainly knew when he couldn't control all the moving parts, but he had his own agenda. He wanted to bring the Americans in a military fashion and yet control the overall narrative by being smarter than the Americans. But he's going up against the very stolid George Marshall, the Secretary of State. So again, this is one of the many little contest, battles, clashes, what have you, whatever you want to call it, within a larger scope. So again, everybody's out for themselves, but Bevin certainly has an idea of how he would like to see the next couple of years go.
Mm. And he and his French counterpart, Georges Bidault, were trying to get, as you suggested, the US to agree to provide military support for Western Europe. Not just economic support, military support during peacetime.
Yes, hard sell.
And Marshall, for a variety of reasons at this stage, was non-committal.
Mm-hmm.
But Bidault sent General Pierre Billot, who was then the member of the French delegation to the UN, to meet with the State Department in the US and try and negotiate some sort of a military arrangement, some sort of a military agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as we said in the last show, you know, part of the US's stipulations on the Marshall Plan money was, well, look, we're going to, if we give you this line of credit, you need to get rid of all of the socialists and communists out of your governments and inside of your country. And the Europeans were like, well, that's easier said than done. We're going to need support in doing that. By the way, you know, we have, you know, we got a very active socialist movements in our countries, probably supported, they all thought at the time, probably incorrectly, supported by Moscow.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to need help defending this money that you're going to give us, defending our economies from these wily socialists. But General Billot reported back to Bidault that the Americans were surprised but pleased by the request. They were like, oh, you're inviting our army into your country during peacetime? Well, gee, let me see. It reminds me of the time the Spanish Bourbons invited Napoleon into their country to lend a hand.
Help us.
They're like, Napoleon, we don't know what we're doing. You seem to know what you're doing. Would you come in and take over? He was like,
if you insist.
Sure.
Oh, all right.
Let me see what I got going on next week. Oh, look, I can fit you in.
Looks at his calendar. How about Tuesday? Tuesday afternoon, I'll come in with a bunch of troops. How's that? But again, the Americans are like,
and they were like, you will give the country back to us later, right? He was like, details. Let's talk about the details later.
That's a later thing. This is a now thing. Let's focus on the here and now.
If there's one thing I've learned from history, it's you never want to think too hard about what comes next. Just do the first thing that comes to your mind and worry about the consequences. That's someone else's problem. Well, consequences.
It's like a Roman making a plan. Step one, fine, I got it. Step two, we'll worry about step two later.
Step one,
don't
kill the guy. Step two,
come what may. George Washington said, let's not get involved in military alliances when Europe. America has been observing that ever since George Washington was around, but needs must, times change, and now the Americans are like, well, why should we give you $13 billion if you're just going to lose your country to the communists? So maybe we should do something.
Yeah, there was a lot of work to be done with Congress, especially the Republicans.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a Democratic White House at the time under Truman. Election's had been coming. In the hands of the Democrats for quite a long time at this stage, like since when did
33?
When did 30? FDR?
30. I think 1930.
30. Yeah.
30
or
31.
So,
yeah,
30. You know, it's
been a minute.
It's been a minute since the Republicans had the White House, and you know they're not all that pleased with the idea of sending money or lines of credit, as it actually turned out to be,
right,
to Europe. Now, you know, partly they're not in the White House, so they're going to criticize any plan that comes out of the White House. Yes. That's just normal politics. And it's somewhat surprising to me that the Republicans were fighting this. I think. Yeah, I mean, you would think that the Republicans would have just as much interest in peacetime military Keynesianism as anyone.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, with your recent midterm elections, the Republicans were saying, well, if, you know, we take the House, we're going to put a stop on funding Ukraine. And I'm like, really, are you, though? Because you have constituents in your electorates that have as much riding on this as anybody. But they have to say things. You have to say things in order to win power. What you do once you're in power, obviously, is quite often different. Yeah, but I also don't think the business model here for investing in the European economy was very well understood. I mean, we can look back on it now and go, "Well, that was a brilliant strategic move to buy Europe, force them into the economic bloc, the American economic bloc." You know, from where we stand today, that was a brilliant strategy, and now one that China is trying to replicate with its Belt and Road initiatives around the world.
Right.
But back then, it hadn't been done before.
Cutting
if you
edge.
Wanted to,
yeah.
If you wanted to take over a bunch of economies, you basically invaded them
old
and
school.
Put up your flag and said, "Oh, motherfuckers, you're dealing with us now."
Right.
Going in with a checkbook instead of a cannon.
Yes.
Was a new idea that hadn't. I mean, it had been, you know, throughout history, governments have given each other money in terms of trying to buy loyalty or buy friendship or whatever.
But this
in and of itself is. But this is a completely different scale.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. You will literally drop all of your barriers. You will do what we say politically, economically, and you will thank us for it. I mean, you know, this is literally bargain basement prices that we're getting Europe for, and again, it is good for us. So, I think, and this is the also in a presidential election year. We have to remember that there are several powerful Republicans running, so you got to bitch about it. But yeah, they would probably stay the course if they had made it to the White House.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, and I think this is, I need to remind myself of this all the time, that, you know, pre-World War II, America had been mostly isolationist.
Yes.
Did get involved in World War One, got involved
imagine,
in trying to fight the Bolsheviks. Yes. But, yeah, hard to imagine an America that tried to stay out of global affairs outside of its immediate, you know,
Latin America
and Hawaii and the Philippines and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, wasn't really isolationist, had invaded the Philippines and that kind of stuff,
to a
part
degree.
Of the Spanish-American War and all that kind of jazz. But,
yeah,
generally speaking, tried to stay out of Europe, but ended up getting dragged in, and particularly after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Now that the World War was over, though, a lot of Americans thought, okay, well, it's time to leave Europe to its own affairs.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of Americans saw Europeans as sort of a little bit backwaterish.
Sure.
With their nobility and their royal families. And they're like, that is weird and old fashioned. We worship the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Trumps. The new gods. Yeah.
They're not the old gods. Yeah. No,
but you
bring up a good point. So, As we've said before, France has got its interests. It's got its main fears. Britain has its main fears. America has its concerns. But what Bevin is going to do is Bevin's going to talk to the French. Foreign Minister Bevin is going to talk to the French. And he's going to go, let's create a treaty or something between us. Well, we'll help you if something bad happens. But it doesn't really mean all that much unless we can bring the Americans in, and they don't want to come in. So we have to ease them in. We have to tease them in. We have to, dare I say, manipulate them in, because they're kind of unwilling to do this. And so there's going to be times when the British and the French are going to work together brilliantly. There's going to be times when they almost sabotage each other because you have your own national interests. But again, it is a game. It is, instead of two people playing chess. It's at least three people playing chess, and the Belgians and the Dutch are going to get involved. So it gets convoluted very quickly, but Europe feels that it needs America's military promise to help if anything happens. So somehow that's got to be worked out, along with the money.
Now, you know, when we say Europe wanted America's help, I mean, as we'll see as we go forwards, like Europe was divided. Not all Europeans wanted America's help.
Yes.
You know, we the way this often gets portrayed is, you know, I've heard certain American friends of mine say, well, these people wanted to be part of NATO. They wanted America involved. They asked us to get involved. Yeah, yeah, one group of them did, but there were lots of groups in Europe that didn't want America involved. They wanted to get closer to Russia. They had their own socialist, communist movements in these countries.
Yes,
that were, you know, very strong. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of public support. They weren't small. They were serious players, as we'll see. But, you know, you had the pro-American camp in these European countries and the pro-Russian camp, and they were fighting amongst each other.
Oh, yes.
But back to the average American, like, I think, you know, with the whole buying of the European economy thing, you can't really talk economics to the masses.
Please don't. Right.
You know, particularly back then, today people are a little bit more aware. We've had, you know, post the 80s, Reagan era, you know, there's a lot more financial literacy, I think, with the post-internet, with people, you know, there's a lot more talk about, you know, the economy and the share market, that kind of stuff today in just mainstream media than there was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, it was very different. It was a very specialized thing. You know, the thinking about the economy and finances and that kind of stuff. And you can't really say to the masses, look, the reason we're setting this money aside that we could be spending on you and on our own economy is, you know, it's a long-term play.
Yeah.
We need to buy... We need to buy these markets. We need to lock them in. That's going to be good for our economy, which means it's going to be good for your job. You can't explain that kind of stuff to the masses. You need to dumb stuff down for the masses. Just so simplistic ideas. Soviets bad, America good, Hulk smash. you know, you need
you
to
get a job. Yeah.
Yeah. You need to dumb it right down. Right. And so that was the tricky thing. Like for the Americans at the time, you know, you had the camp that wanted to invest in Europe via the Marshall Plan, and then they wanted to protect it militarily.
Right.
You had the camp that was arguing against that for domestic political reasons, if nothing else. And it was much easier to argue the against case because that was America's tradition, isolationism.
Always,
right?
Yes.
To argue for a permanent military presence in Europe during peacetime, there's a big, big leap of imagination
disconnect
for Americans in 1947, 1948.
Yeah, because why? And you can't tell them why. Too convoluted.
Well, you know, Churchill had already given his Iron Curtain speech, and you go, well, Soviets are bad, but still Americans are like, well, hold on, these were our allies.
Yeah, just yesterday.
Fucking yesterday, yeah. They were our allies. Now you're saying they're the bad guys.
I'm
like,
so confused.
Let me catch my breath here for a second. Our old friend John Foster Dulles, at this stage, was, you know, this is 47, 48, was possibly going to be the next Secretary of State if the Republicans won the White House in 1948. He had been sent to Paris for the Foreign Minister Conference by the senior Republicans. And he left France convinced that they needed America's help. Now, key thing for everyone to understand is that France and Italy, at the time, 1947, 1948, were beset by labor strikes.
Oh, yes.
Very strong communist parties in both countries.
Yes.
Like there was in Greece. We've talked about the one in Greece and how the British and the Americans, primarily the British, had to go in and shut down the communists in Greece.
Through violence.
Same thing was happening in France and Italy.
Yeah.
And Dulles was convinced that these countries needed immediate military policing support from the United States. The 1947 strikes in France were there was a series of very large insurrectionist labor actions across the country, partly against post-war wage stagnation, but partly against Western capitalism. Like, people still remembered the Great Depression.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they remembered that capitalism kept failing them time and time again.
Yes.
And, you know, they were fighting for a better system. They wanted a fairer system. You know, a lot of intellectuals that had read their Marx and Engels and their Lenin, and they were passionate about, you know, the idea that there's a better way of distributing and managing the wealth of a country.
Yeah.
So these strikes in France started in April 1947 at the largest Renault factory in the country. 10,000 out of 30,000 workers went on strike.
Good God.
And initially, the French Communist Party, the PCF, wasn't involved in the strikes.
Oh.
It reminds me of, like, Russia in 1917 when the strikes happened and Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin were all out of the country at the time, and they were like, wait, you can't do that. I'm your leader. Wait till I get back.
Let me get there. Yeah, yeah.
The Communist Party had nothing to do with it. They were, in fact, against it initially. Then they got on board.
Right.
And that led to the May crises, as they're known, in France and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the French ones I'm talking about,
right.
Which saw all of the communist officials expelled from the government of France.
Dang.
They had this tripartisme thing going on at the time. It was like this alliance between various political parties. And they kicked the communists out. There was this rumor going around that came to the attention of the French president at the time, Ramadier, that there was going to be a major insurrection. But at the time, the French Communist Party was quite powerful. One in every four voters.
Yeah.
25% of the vote was going to the French Communist Party between 1946 and 1956. You know, they were getting very large percentages of the votes in France. Very popular.
Yes.
And Ramadier, the president, had received warnings from the US ambassador, Jefferson Caffrey, that any communists in the French government would prevent them from getting Marshall Plan money.
Ooh. Is that the carrot or the stick? Because it feels like it's a little of both. Look, we've got something pretty sweet for you. And I hate not to give it to you. It's up to you. It's up to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and you know, the so you're Ramadier, you're the president, you've got communists in your government that were elected.
Yes.
In a democracy.
Legally elected. And that was the
legally
fear.
Elected.
Yes.
And The Americans are saying, well, you've got to get rid of them in your government. He goes, hold on.
We don't
care. They were voted in a democracy. Yeah, don't care about democracy.
Nope.
Democracy, schmocracy. You want the money, you've got to get rid of these guys. So Ramadier is trying to figure out what to do about this. Caffrey wrote in his diary, I told Ramadier no communists in government or else.
Damn. Like Joe Biden.
What does the or else mean? Well, yeah, like Joe Biden to Ukraine.
Exactly. No cash. No cash for you.
You need more Nazis, Biden said to Zelensky. You need more Nazis in your government or else. So Ramadier began looking for some sort of a pretext to purge the communists from the government.
Right.
And then as these strikes were happening across 1947, a rumor started circulating amongst the government that the communists were plotting a coup for the 1st of May.
There you go.
And the military was secretly mobilized, and he expelled all of the communist ministers from the government on the 5th of May, 1947. The strikes continued, though, across France. In September, there was one that was sort of more run by the common form, more generalized strike.
Right.
Which explicitly denounced the Marshall Plan and the conditions involved with accepting Marshall Plan funds. There were 3 million strikers. It's estimated that 23,371,000 working days were lost to strikes in France in 1947.
Damn.
So it was a big deal being led by the communist and socialist parties in France.
Yeah. But if I could real quick, I mean, you're right. Even though the war was a horrible thing, it's over with, and people's memories go back to before the war, and they're like, it's going to happen again in some form or some fashion. Money is going to become worthless, or it's going to lose value. We're all going to lose jobs. We don't have benefits. And yeah, I mean, they remember this stuff, and we're going to see. I think it's probably going to be in the next episode, but there's going to be a little tiny country in Europe that has a better social net then in 1920 that America has today in 2022. So these people were looking for some security from their governments. And I don't think they were asking for too much, but it did not fit the needs of the governments of the various countries.
Mm.
Sorry.
So these strikes continued into 1948, and this is the sort of problem John Foster Dulles is worried about. Like, what happens if we give these countries billions of dollars of credit and then they get taken over by the communists and join the Russian trading bloc instead,
with our money.
The Soviet bloc? Yeah. What do we do?
Yeah.
By the way, these strikes in France were broken using covert support from the CIA.
Of course.
Even earlier, the CIA or the OSS, whatever it actually was at the time, had begun funding and arming the Guerini crime family, a.k.a. the Corsican Mafia in Marseille, to assault communist picket lines and harass union officials.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several striking workers who got murdered by the Guerinis at this time. They were also, the Guerini crime family were Lucky Luciano's partners for shipping heroin into the United States at the time.
Jesus.
So, yeah, we've talked, I think, on the War on Drugs series, we talked about the CIA's involvement with Corsican Mafia during World War II, all that kind of stuff.
Who was the Australian that was leading strikes? He was a big guy. I think it was in California, and literally preachers and policemen and whatever else were actually encouraging violence against those who were striking, and people did die. People were killed because they were striking for better wages or for whatever. But I mean, when you have priests on the side, on the far right, on the side of the cops and the side of the politicians, you know something's gone wonky. But yeah, any means necessary to win, that's what's going on here right now.
Harry Bridges.
There we go. That's thank who
you're
you.
Talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah. Victor Santoki, my dear departed friend in LA, was the guy who first told me about Harry Bridges.
That's right. Rest in peace.
Yeah. So this is what Dulles is worried about. Mm. Oh, and the CIA's involved. Yeah, you know, we believe in democracy and the right of the people to choose, unless they choose the wrong thing. Right. And then
we'll fuck them up.
Then we need to get involved.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Italy,
on
the 1st of May 1947, the nation was thrown into crisis by the murder of 11 peasants, including 4 children, at an International Workers' Day parade in Palermo by Salvatore Giuliano, the great uncle of your own Mr. Giuliani, my good friend.
Your cigar buddy.
My cigar buddy, Giuliani. Right. Yeah. Rudy! Ruru. As I used to call him back in the day.
Was this, how should I put this delicately, remover of problems in Italy, was he being paid by someone, or was he under the direction of anyone? Or was he just a patriot?
No, he was just a patriot who didn't like commies. Right. Salvatore Giuliano was an Italian bandit, not part of the mafia as such, I don't think. He was just running his own little Sicilian operation.
Gotcha.
Had a gang. This is known as the Portella della Ginestra massacre.
Mm-hmm.
May 1st, 1947, hundreds of poor peasants gathered at Portella della Ginestra, which is about 3 kilometres from the town of Piana dei Albanesi,
right,
named after Australia's current Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese.
I knew that.
They were on their way to San Giuseppe Giotto for a Labor Day parade.
Mm-hmm.
At 10:15 in the morning, the Communist Party secretary began to address the crowd when gunfire broke out. Later determined that machine guns had been fired from the surrounding hills, as well as by men on horseback. 11 people were killed, including 4 children.
Jesus.
27 people were wounded, including a little girl who had her jaw shot off.
I can't. Jesus Christ. Collateral damage.
The attack was attributed to Giuliano. Mm-hmm. He had wanted to punish local leftists for their recent election results. The massacre took place 12 days after the surprise victory by Blocco del Popolo, the People's Bloc. It was a coalition of Italian Communist Party and Socialist parties, mm-hmm, in the elections for the Constituent Assembly.
Right.
The People's Bloc obtained 29% of the vote. The Christian Democrats got 20%, and the other parties came third and fourth. So, again, like in France,
yeah,
the Socialists and Communist parties in Italy were very popular in, yes, the late 40s. Now, Giuliano, before this massacre, Giuliano had been sort of perceived as a bit of a Robin Hood in Sicily. Yeah. He would steal from or even kidnap wealthy Sicilians and help impoverished Sicilians.
Right.
His most famous robbery happened in 1944, the robbery of the Duchess of Pratamenno,
right,
Lesser Prada. He and his men snuck into her estate unnoticed,
mm-hmm,
and then he was in her bedroom.
Right.
Before she knew what was occurring, he kissed her hand.
Oh, that's nice.
Bowed, showed respect for her noble status, right, then demanded she hand over all her jewelry. When she refused, he threatened to kidnap her children. So she handed the loot over. He took a diamond ring from her hand, which he wore for the rest of his life.
Oh, classic.
Then he borrowed her copy of John Steinbeck's In Dubious Battle, which he then read and returned with a thank you note a week later.
Class act. Class. And he was an educated thief. So good for him.
Yeah, class act until he killed a bunch of children and peasants. Yeah. And then they put a bounty on his head. It was like $13,200 in 1947. So about, I don't know, 150, 200 grand in today's money.
Yeah.
Offered by the Italian government for his capture. It became a national scandal. And the communist-controlled Italian General Confederation of Labour called a general strike in protest against the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 million workers across Italy went on strike. The communist leaders were, you know, getting up and giving speeches.
Right.
The media at the time were reporting rumours that there was going to be a civil war led by the communists in Italy.
Right. Yeah, they want something new. Sorry, go ahead.
And the Italian government used that as a pretext to kick out all of the left-wing ministers from their cabinet on the 31st of May. All the Italian Socialist Party and the Communist Party members of cabinet. So, again, like in France, mm-hmm, Italy knows that in order to get Marshall Plan money, they need to get rid of the communists and the socialists out of government.
Right.
Was there any connection between that and Giuliano's massacre and the you know, then the protests and then using that as a pretext? We don't know. Giuliani never said. He was assassinated a few years later himself.
So we'll never know.
But, you know, so this is the thing about even the Marshall Plan, leaving aside NATO.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear American defenders of the Marshall Plan and of NATO say, well, the countries wanted to be involved in this. They asked to get involved.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah, some of them did. The ones that weren't crushed,
right,
oppressed,
a percentage
wanted to be in it.
Did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ones that were pro-American and were able to, you know, kick out the democratically elected, by the way, democratically elected members of their government that on America's orders or threats they had to kick out of their own governments. That is what we're talking about here with the Marshall Plan. It's not the, rainbows and unicorns version of the story that it gets taught in civics class in America.
It's the details, and the devil's always in the details.
The United States and the UK thought anything involving communists had to be part of a sinister plan by Stalin to take over the world.
Like Korea. Yeah,
sorry. Yeah, it couldn't just be seen as a domestic situation. Yes. It had to be seen as this grand, evil, cunning, Dr. Evil plan to take over the world. Democratic Senator J. William Fulbright of Arkansas, he of the Fulbright scholarship.
Which I never got. Go ahead.
Again, we're all shocked. Speaking at the University of Toronto, warned that the continent in its present fragmentary form is a large power vacuum which Russia is trying to fill. Let us be under no illusions. If Russia obtains control of Western Europe, the control of Africa, the Near East, and the Middle East will fall into her lap like a ripe plum. They should be our ripe plums, not their ripe plums.
Yes, our plums. Our plums.
Reach down. My plums, feel it in my plums.
Here's an idea. No one really wants a master, whether it's a political master, an economic master. It's not like the Europeans are going, oh, and someone take care of us. You know, the Europeans are intelligent, complicated people, just like anyone else. But they are certainly in desperate straits right now. And they don't want to be in the middle of this boxing match between America and the Soviet Union. But they are. And so you have some that pick one side and some that pick the other. And it's going to get dirty, and it's going to keep getting dirty. And America can say that we, you know, plausible deniability, we didn't know. But at the end, at the very, very end of the Marshall Plan, there's little things like this, not little, but things, violent things like this that are happening. And we can't just pretend that we did not know or it had nothing to do with us. You know, live and learn.
On January 13th, 1948, the British ambassador to the United States, Lord Inverchapel,
good name,
presented a proposal to George Marshall, which insisted on U.S. military support for recipients of the Marshall Plan, but it had to go through the State Department, and that meant it had to go across the desk of our old friend George Kenan Thompson. Who, before he was the longest-running cast member on Saturday Night Live, was the director of the State Department's policy planning staff. And Kennan had serious objections to the Inverchapel proposal. He didn't really like the idea of a military union in Europe. Now, to remind people playing at home, or maybe new players to the game, for you, George Kennan was... had been based, part of the State Department. He was a diplomat, had been based in Moscow for many, many years before World War II.
Right.
Was considered one of the leading experts on the Soviet Union and on Stalin, on Russia in the U.S. State Department. Wrote the X telegram or the long telegram after World War II that became the philosophical basis for the idea of containment of the Soviet Union. So he's considered sort of the godfather of the Cold War. But the way that America executed this plan did not meet with his liking. He was a critic of America's understanding or lack thereof of Russia and his plan. So he wasn't. He wasn't a big fan of the idea of a military involvement by the U.S. And later on, many years later, I was reading his memoirs last week, and he wrote this about this period. The Russians had no intention of attacking Western Europe in those post-war years and thought we must have known it.
Right.
Because they'd been fucking telling you this for years, but you didn't believe them. For this reason, the manner in which NATO was formed and presented to the Western public, i.e. as a response to the Soviet threat and as a deterrent to Soviet aggression, mystified them and caused them to search for some sinister hidden motive in our policy.
Yes.
This effect had been reinforced by our steps toward the rearmament of Germany and Japan, and by the manner in which we ourselves had interpreted and presented our action in Korea, and by Leninist doctrine, which told them that the social foundation of the capitalist order disintegrated in the West, the leaders of the exploiting class, i.e. the Western governments, would go from one form of attack to other, sharper forms of attack.
Right.
Which is not a bad analysis of Western imperialism. Now, Kennan, right, before he died in the mid-1990s, late 1990s, 96, 97, was also very critical of Bill Clinton's stated intention to expand NATO after the collapse of the USSR.
Yeah.
Kennan, you know, right at the end of his life was saying, this is bad.
Yeah.
Russians aren't going to like this. They're going to see it as a threat and they're going to have to eventually respond to that threat, et cetera, which has, you know, led to the current goings on in Ukraine. So Kennan, not a fan of the idea of NATO from the very get-go.
Yeah. If I could real quick, when we were doing the CIA series, we joked that the CIA was inept to the point where it could not get an agent, an asset inside the Iron Curtain. And so we literally knew nothing of what was going on. But at the same token, one of the great tragedies of the beginning of the Cold War is that Soviets didn't get us. They're like, we don't want to invade you. We can't invade you. However, we cannot stress this enough. World War I, World War II, the whole question of Poland, the Polish corridor, this is a matter of life and or death to us. This is not about politics. This is not about economics. This is literally our existence, our lives, our family, our children, generations to come. We have to lock down something like Poland in some form or fashion, because clearly Europe can't control itself, and it's only a matter of time before some other army comes at us. So we didn't get Soviet Union, but they could not understand our anger, our fear at them. And the reason we were so angry and fearful of them, besides the economic matters, was we didn't understand them. We didn't get them. We didn't really want to get them, but we did not know what was going on. When you have two sides that literally do not get the other side, they don't understand what's going on, you're going to have nothing but distrust and fear. And so there suddenly are no rules. You do whatever you have to win, because you can only imagine the worst thing possible coming from the other side. So nothing but a lack of communication and distrust and fear is kind of what helps launch the Cold War. And this, and we're seeing it here as well. The Americans are actually going to ask the Soviets to join the Marshall Plan, knowing that they can't, knowing that even if they wanted to, Congress would never approve it. So we are maneuvering the Soviets into a certain position where they look like the bad guy. We get to claim victimhood, and they're the bad guys, and we have to stop them because they want to take over the world. Why America is writing checks and taking over the world in a different way. So very convoluted, but yeah. So the Marshall Plan is like just like you were saying earlier, what the British foreign minister said. This is truly the beginning of the Western Bloc, and if you have a Western Bloc, you're damn sure going to have an Eastern Bloc, and they're going to stare at each other. Hopefully no one uses weapons or nuclear weapons at any point. But that's how it gets started.
On the 22nd of January 1948, Ernest Bevins, Foreign Minister of the United Kingdom, gave a very influential speech to the House of Commons. I read the speech. Good speech. He gave good speech.
Yeah.
Ernie Bevins even dealt with his hecklers pretty well. Did you read the speech?
I read some of the when he would fire back at the criticisms, and I would not want to debate this guy. He was tearing them a new one. Brilliant. Yeah.
So he gave a speech. Basically, he warned that the Soviets were going to try and influence Western Europe to become communist, and they needed to stop them.
Right.
Why? Because something wicked this way comes. No,
because I don't like it. I don't fucking like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, Britain, look, yes, Britain was involved in Greece.
Yeah.
In, you know, helping determine the outcome of the elections in Greece to make sure that the Greeks voted properly and didn't get any crazy ideas into their heads. Yeah. And he said, look, we would love to get out of Greece. Trust me, yeah. There's nothing more we would love than to disengage out of Greece. But gosh darn it. Those sneaky Soviets are still trying to support the Greek communists, so I guess we need to stay involved too.
Don't want to.
Have to. Like,
it's a damn shame.
We would love to bring our boys home, but we just need to keep them there to make sure the Greeks don't get any silly ideas.
Right.
What do the Greeks know about democracy anyway? now, in this speech, he also talked about the idea of a European Union,
Ooh.
A union of West European countries.
Right.
He talked about the Marshall Plan, but the main thrust of his speech was that in order to rebuild Western Europe, some kind of Western European Union, they needed to defend Europe from the USSR
right.
and more domestic communist movements. Now, this is a big deal because up until this point, the British had not wanted to point the finger at the USSR too much.
Right, don't piss them
off. Like the Treaty of Dunkirk that they signed with France that you mentioned early on, it was all about an alliance to defend themselves against Germany in the future.
Yeah.
But most historians, like Mark Trachtenberg at University of California and others, say that, well, using Germany, it was really just a pretext for the Russia, the USSR. Exactly. It was like, well, we say Germany, we mean the USSR. We just don't want to say the USSR because we're still trying to figure out if we can all get along. Yeah. And they were still, you know, meeting, having foreign ministers meetings about the future of Germany and all this kind of stuff. It still hadn't settled. The dust hadn't settled yet on that whole thing.
Don't poke the bear.
But, well, Bevan did poke it. Bevan came out and said, we need to defend ourselves against the Soviet Union and the communists. He said that Britain intended to take the lead in the creation of this new union, which they saw as an extension of the Treaty of Dunkirk.
Right.
And his speech was received well, both at home and in the USA. So Bevan tried to close the deal. And you know, the way that scholars talk about this speech, it was directed at the USA. It was basically a way of him communicating directly with the US public, saying, you know, we want to build a better Europe, a prosperous Europe, but we really need America's support against the evil communists.
We can't do it without you. And see, this is where some of the nuances come in, because before the speech, well, first of all, the Dunkirk treaty is, France is still worried. France's main concern is a resurgent Germany. So here's what Britain does. Britain goes, okay, look, for the next 50 years, if you were attacked by Germany, we will come in. We will put troops on the ground on the continent, and we will help you. But some of the other countries, like the Dutch and Belgium, are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Germany is currently occupied. Germany is not the problem. Quit talking about them. Be real. Tell everybody what you're really thinking. And, of course, like you just said, it's like, no, we can't openly, publicly say that we're afraid of the Soviets, because that might piss them off, or it might piss off the communists in these various European countries. And so it is Bevan who's like, we need a union, but we need the Americans a part of this union, and it would really be nice if they would let the British run it, because the British are used to telling people what to do. And so he's being clever. He's finally put it out there. It's like, okay, it's out of the bag now. We're afraid of the Soviet Union. But the Americans are still like, again, we're not exactly all that keen on some kind of military treaty during peacetime. So it's a delicate balance that he's got going on. Some people in America like what he said. Some people in America didn't like what he said. But the point is, America's going to figure out very quickly, one, they have to placate the French with their fear of the Germans, even though at this point it's unfounded. The French are thinking about the future. Britain wants to be in charge of it, but America is the big boy on the block now because, you know, because of our industrial might. So you have these various factions all trying to get into certain positions, but unless they can all agree, this is not going to happen. So someone's got to give somewhere to make this happen. And this is just Bevan's opening salvo to try to finally, like you said, not only put this out there, but also close the deal very quickly. And he almost does it, but he doesn't quite, because there's enough people in America going, I still don't know about this. Let's just wait and see what happens. And George Marshall, the Secretary of State, is one of them.
Mm. Yeah, Bevan tries to close the deal after his speech is received well, and he's having talks with the US, and he says while he recognizes the difficulty that the United States might have in committing forces to Europe during peacetime, he said that if the two nations joined in a general commitment to go to war with an aggressor, it is probable that the potential victims will feel sufficiently reassured to refuse to embark on a fatal policy of appeasement.
Ah, right. This goes back to that, and I didn't really research this. Did you run across what was the expression? The spiritual aspect of a treaty.
Yeah. It's a spiritual alliance.
A spiritual alliance. Exactly right. So it's like, let me give you something that's going to give you hope.
Like
give
you and you me. Faith.
Exactly.
Spiritual and sexual alliance. That's
how
Bevan wanted.
And heads up, if you ever meet Cam, the first one leads to the second one. So watch yourself. But anyway, it was that idea.
The whole purpose of spirituality and religion, Ray, is to get one laid. I keep telling you, that's why I started my own religion, the cult of Cam.
I joined Uncle Cam's corner, but I still got laid. So either way, it's all good. But no, I love this spiritual aspect. He's like, I haven't got you people to write down, I haven't gotten you people to sign any documents yet, but I think we can all agree we need some kind of gathering, some kind of understanding, some kind of treaty. I'm just trying to work out the details, and he's trying to bring the Americans along. It's just going to take a little longer than what he thinks it should.
Mm. But the U.S. State Department had a schism between the people that wanted military involvement in Europe and the people who didn't. The people who didn't, we talked about this, Kennan.
Right.
There's also Charles Bolin. Right. We've talked about him in recent past episodes. Charles Bolin was another American diplomat, ambassador, and another expert on the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. He'd lived there, been the ambassador there for many, many years.
Right.
Funny that the two guys who knew most about the USSR were the ones against NATO.
Not cool, guys. Not cool.
Yeah. Including the guy that basically started the Cold War, Kennan, was against NATO. Other voices in the USA who were against the Marshall Plan, we mentioned Henry Wallace before, FDR's former VP and Secretary of Agriculture, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
He said that both the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine should be scrapped because they were provocations to the USSR. Herbert Hoover,
right.
former president, urged Congress to scrap the Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
He wanted to replace it with a different model of aid, something that was more open-ended and not tied down as much with as many stipulations as the Marshall Plan had in it, or the ERP as it was known had in it.
Mm-hmm.
Robert A. Taft, who was the most influential Republican in the Senate, attacked it for being too large and for failing to have an administrator independent of the State Department. Glad America learned that lesson, and now, whenever they raise billions and billions of dollars to send to foreign countries, it's everyone knows exactly where every penny is gone.
Every pallet.
And none of it just disappears into the mists. Yeah.
And Taft is going to run for president in 48, so he's a little self-serving as well.
Everybody is self-serving. Yeah. I mean, everyone's got an agenda, of course. But my point is just that there were very, very senior people in the United States in terms of politicians as well as thinkers who and experts on Russia who were against the Marshall Plan and against NATO at the time. But then the event that really lit a fire under their asses is a bit like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld sitting around after they got elected in 2000 going, God, we really, really want to invade Iraq.
Need it.
What would be really great is if just something big happened. If something really big happened that, you know,
shook everybody.
Gave us an excuse to invade Iraq, wouldn't that be great?
People would beg us to invade. Beg us.
Yeah. I wonder if we know anyone. Mm. Make some phone calls. Mm. See who's up. Who's awake. Who's up.
I remember when Bush said, you know, I just wanted to be the education president. That's all I wanted. And then this horrible thing came along. I guess I'll have to do this, you know, war thing. But he wanted to be the education. Anyways, please continue.
So in this case, their 9/11 was the communist coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia that happened on the 24th of February, 1948.
Yes.
Shocked the world, especially disturbing to the United States because of its very close history with Czechoslovakia since the country was founded after World War One, or sort of towards the end of World War One.
Mm-hmm.
All concerns about offending the USSR disappeared overnight.
Gone. The worst has come true. Because, what the fuck? Yeah.
Like, this is a point in time where the Chinese Civil War is still going on.
Yes.
Not really bedded down yet by the communists. Mm-hmm. It's close, though.
Right.
But, you know, this is a world before Vietnam, before Ho Chi Minh. Yeah. It's a world before Korea. It's in a world before Fidel Castro. So to see another country fall to communists in a coup d'état...
Yes.
Was, I mean, they'd had Russia, fine,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the Soviet, other Soviet countries at that time, but to see another country fall to a communist coup d'etat, one that had been very closely associated with the West for decades, was a massive shock. And Bevin and others... said, okay, well, now is the time for immediate action. No more dilly-dallying.
Right.
Bevin said that he feared Europe was now in a critical period of 6 to 8 weeks, which would decide the fate of Europe.
Ooh.
So I think we'll end it there. When we come back next time, we'll have to talk about Czechoslovakia and the communist coup of 1948.
Curtain has descended across the continent.